Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. For today's podcast, I reached out to some amazing women in a Facebook group that I belong to called She Podcasts. I asked them to submit questions that they had about wine that they either didn't want to ask in public or didn't necessarily know where to find the answers. They responded with some great questions. I am sure they are not the only ones with these questions, so I hope that my answers can help some of you learn a little bit more about wine. And please let me know if you have any questions that are not covered here. And before we get into the podcast, I would like to wish everyone a very happy new year. As we approach 2020, remember the words of Eleanor Roosevelt. The future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams. First up, Rachel C. asked, what is the difference between cheap wine and expensive wine? Well, you know what? This is a great question. There is a lot that goes into the production of wine that must be considered when putting a dollar value on that bottle. Generally speaking, it's the location, aging, and time. So let's start in the vineyard itself, right? The price of the fruit is a large portion of that cost. For example, fruit from highly prestigious vineyards in Napa Valley could go for $10,000, even $25,000 a ton. That cost is going to increase the price of the bottle you are purchasing. So depending on where the fruit comes from, that's going to be a starting point for the cost of that bottle. Where the fruit is located in relation to the winery itself can also impact the price of wine. If the winery is harvesting fruit from all over, that requires time and labor, requiring the fruit to be trucked a far distance to the winery. That will also add a dollar amount. The next big impact on the cost of a bottle of wine is how the wine is aged. Wine can be aged in a multitude of ways, such as stainless steel, concrete, or oak. Each new oak barrel can run the winery between $1,200 and $2,500 per barrel. On the lower end of the spectrum, each new barrel will add about $4 to the price of that bottle. Stainless steel may be a large initial outlay to the winery, but since it can be used over and over, the cost can be spread out over multiple vintages. And that's the same with a concrete aging. The final major component of the price of a bottle of wine is the time it spends before being released. When a winery holds back the wine to age, it requires space, and that costs money. Wineries want to hold back the release of their wines because time not only changes the taste of the fruit flavors in wine, but also reduces the acidity and the tannin in the wine. We want to release the wine at its best peak time. You can figure that for each year the wine is held prior to release adds about $1 to $2 per bottle to that cost. Additional costs can be added due to marketing, cost of the bottle, the glass itself, corks, capsules, labels. All of these add up and increase the price of your bottle of wine. A cheaper wine would tend to be mass-produced from a not-so-well-known wine region, aged for a short period of time in stainless steel, and typically released rather quickly. Next up, and I apologize if I am mispronouncing your name, Naira B. asked, I really can't taste the earthy or fruit flavors in wine. What do I do? Well, you know what, Naira? You are not alone. Learning to taste a wine takes experience. The good thing is that it's super easy to remedy. Just drink more wine. Tasting wine is a science. You do not need to be a scientist to enjoy wine. Anybody can take a sip of wine out of any old glass and decide whether or not they like it. But to truly taste wine, you are delving deeply into science. You may not even be aware of it, and you don't really necessarily need to be, but you are. Tasting involves using your senses. Taste is possible because we have taste buds on our tongue. Our taste buds sit on raised protrusions called papillae. Although there are four types of papillae, only 3 hold taste buds involved with gestation. So in terms of wine, we focus in on only 3 of these categories. Sugar cannot be detected when it is less than 1%. Sour comes from the acid in the wine and is described as tart. And bitterness comes from the tannins created by the seeds and skin and provides an astringent mouthfeel. Initially, it may be tough to recognize and describe aromas and bouquets in wine. Plus, everyone is not the same. What I perceive as cherry may not be what you perceive as cherry. So how do we train our palate to taste the flavors within wine? Go shopping. Go to your local grocery store and purchase fruit and other popular tasting profiles and taste them. Teach your palate what a blackberry or a pink grapefruit tastes like. Grab passion fruit or stewed tomatoes. Pick up some olives. I know it sounds weird, but grab a rock. Make sure all the dirt is off of it. Lick it to see what a wet stone tastes like. Take a whiff of some fresh dirt. Take a walk through woods after a rainstorm. Your brain can only differentiate what it knows. So you have to provide memories for it to recall. Another fun way to gain experience is to head to the candy world. I often recommend picking up different flavors of jelly beans and tasting them. Jelly Belly makes jelly beans in pretty much any flavor possible. Go pick them out, taste them. Have a tasting party, have friends over, taste the different jelly beans so that you can experience what those flavors are. I would just recommend not sampling cat pee. And yes, that is a legit tasting note for Sauvignon Blanc. Brianna A. asks, what's a good wine for someone who doesn't like wine? What foods pair well with what wines? And what does it take to become a sommelier? If you have someone who isn't the biggest wine lover, I would suggest choosing a lighter wine. I would stay away from those big, bold Cabernet Sauvignons or that sweetness of a Sauternes and would suggest avoiding high alcohol wines. Some nice white suggestions would be a Pinot Grigio, Pinot Blanc, or a Sauvignon Blanc. These wines do not tend to be overpowering and are typically easy sippers. If you prefer to serve a red option, I am always a fan of opening a Merlot for new-to-wine people. Another good light wine suggestion is a Pinot Noir. The tannin structure in these wines are light enough that they are not overbearing. In terms of food pairings, the purpose of food pairing is for both the food and the wine to provide more pleasure than either would when they were consumed alone. So when choosing the pairing, you should take into account the preferences of the individual as well as the basic interactions between food and wine. There are some basic rules that you can adhere to. Sugar and umami will harden the wine, meaning it will make it more astringent or bitter, while lowering the sensation of sweetness and fruit in the wine. On the opposite side of the spectrum, salty and acidic foods will soften the wine, making it taste less astringent, less bitter or acidic, while increasing the sensation of sweetness and fruit. Generally speaking, food has a larger impact on how the wine tastes than the opposite. If you are choosing a wine to pair with a dessert, the general rule of thumb is to select a wine with a higher level of sugar than the food. If you are serving a meal that is high in fat or oil, you may want to choose a high acid wine, such as a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, a Champagne, or a Loire Valley wine, such as Sancerre or Vouvray, or the white wines of an Alsace from Germany. For salty meals, look for a sweet wine. And for those spicy dishes, stay away from extremely high alcohol. If you would like to hear some specific pairings, please search for Winefabet Street episodes on this podcast. In these episodes, we provide the history and general characteristics of a specific grape variety and provide recipe suggestions to pair with them. The last part of the question, what does it take to be a sommelier? Well, a sommelier is someone who is skilled in advanced sensory evaluation and service techniques. Their focus is generally working in the hospitality industry. They take extensive classes in viticulture, enology, tasting, and food and wine pairings, as well as service instruction. During their training, they will taste wines from around the world and are expected to understand their differences and be able to explain those differences to potential customers. Prospective sommeliers can acquire professional credentials by completing a certification program. If you would like to learn more about wine and earn certifications, but aren't interested in working in the hospitality industry, there are other options available to you, such as the WSET program or Certified Wine Specialist. Keep in mind that you can become a sommelier even if you are not certified. You just need to have the knowledge, but being certified will help you stand out among others who are competing for that same position. Emily W. asks, are the aerators worthwhile purchases or are they just gimmicks? Well, you know what, Emily? This is kind of a difficult question to answer because I really do believe that aerators affect the taste of the wine. They can enhance the aromas. So there is a positive to these aerators. They work by exposing the wine to oxygen. When microoxygenation occurs, the flavor profile of the wine is enhanced. That's proven. But it is important to remember that not all wines need to be aerated, and even more importantly, aerating certain wines can actually ruin their complexity and destroy their profile completely. So generally speaking, younger red wines with a higher tannin profile or older aged wines that have accumulated sediment are the wines that you are typically going to aerate. The simplest form of aeration is decanting. And although there are some very fancy, elegant, and expensive decanters out there, you can just as easily get the same effect by pouring your wine into any glass structure, like a vase or pitcher you already have sitting around the house, and allowing the wine to sit for an hour or more prior to drinking. So there lies the problem. I don't know about you, but more often than not, I am not thinking about the wine I am going to open for dinner 2 hours prior to dinner. I'm more likely running around doing errands, or I'm at work. This is where the concept of wine aerators come from. The aerator gadgets work by forcing air through a funnel, allowing the wine to interact with the oxygen. But keep in mind that aerating does take some experience and talent, as wine will only peak for a brief period of time before those flavors and aromas you are trying to enhance begin to flatten and are lost. Do I feel everyone needs to or should own an aerator? No, I don't. A lot depends on the individual's level of wine appreciation. A relatively young wine drinker may not taste the difference between an aerated and a non-aerated wine. Statistics show that most wine is purchased and consumed within 72 hours. These wines are not going to benefit from aerating. If you are someone who falls under this category, an aerator is not a necessary gadget for you. But if you are a wine collector that stores your wine for years, then it is something you may want to invest in, and they're not really that expensive. There are a lot of gadgets out there, but if we purchase every single one, we would all be broke. Jennifer R. wrote, I drink less expensive wine at home, but when I bring a bottle of wine to a hostess, I want to impress. What should I look for when I'm at the store to feel confident I'm getting a good quality wine? First, I think that if you enjoy a bottle of wine, no matter the cost, it makes for a good hostess gift. If you like it, they may also. But if you want to bring something different, my first suggestion is to determine the price range you are comfortable with spending. That will narrow your choices down. When looking at labels, there are certain terms that give the impression of quality that can impress. Such as reserve. It is impressive. However, it really doesn't have a legal definition. It is named that for the fact that the winery or winemaker feels that something about that wine is better. So for example, our reserve Cabernet Franc is a single clone, single vineyard Cabernet Franc. So we feel that it is special and thereby we've deemed it reserve. Other terms on labels that may impress your host is single vineyard, estate grown. These two terms do have legal definitions, and although not necessarily translating to increased quality, they typically are viewed that way. You can look for wines that are from specific regions that are known for quality. Some examples, but definitely not limited to, include Mount Veeder or the Maipo Valley for Cabernet Sauvignon, Howell Mountain for Zinfandel, Mendoza for Malbec, Alsace for Riesling, or Marlboro for Sauvignon Blanc. Another option is to download one of the wine apps, such as Vivino, Delectable, or Cellar Tracker. These apps are all free, and they allow you to scan the bottle or UPC code, and they will provide you with reviews from other people who have had that wine. You can look at the average rating of the wine and read what people have to say about it, and then you're making an educated decision on whether or not you want to buy that bottle. Megan W. wrote that she had just purchased her first older wines, 20 years and 15 years, and she could not get the corks out. They crumbled. She wanted to know if she messed up or is this normal. So Megan, it is definitely normal. Hey, this can happen very frequently with older wines. Although a crumbling cork doesn't always mean that the wine is compromised, it often could be a hint that it was. So I'm hoping that was not what occurred with you. I hope that when you did finally get that wine out, the wine cork out, that you were able to enjoy that wine. But don't just throw the wine down the sink. Make sure you give it a taste, because it may be perfectly fine. And those extra, you know, cork crumbles that are in there, those floaters, you can always get rid of them by pouring the wine through a coffee filter or a strainer. So let's start off with some bad reasons why this may have happened. We store our wines horizontally to keep the cork wet. When a bottle of wine is left upright, as it is in a lot of stores, the wine is not in contact with the cork, and over time it can begin to dry and will become brittle. The cork itself may have just been faulty from the get-go, such as being punched out in the wrong shape, it may have been inserted into the bottle incorrectly, or it may have been exposed to heat or dry conditions. Remember that cork isn't exactly the strongest material in the world, and since it is natural, it will begin to decay as it gets older. So even if the bottle was stored in perfect condition, you may still see crumbling in the corks of older wines. When you're opening an older bottle, you want to pay attention to the type of wine opener you're using. A cheap winged corkscrew tends to shred a cork, enhancing that crumbling of an older cork. So choose a waiter's key that is thin and be sure to insert it into the center of the cork. Be sure to insert deeply, since if you only put it partially in, less than half of the way, the cork can actually just split in half. Pull it up slowly, and if you see any signs of crumbling, stop immediately. When opening an older bottle, I typically use what is called an osso. This is a bottle opener that is also known as a two-prong puller. It does not have a screw worm at all. Instead, you insert the two prongs on either side of the cork after removing the capsule. So there is a longer and shorter prong. You're going to insert the longer one first, followed by the shorter one, and you're shimmying the osso back and forth until it's like all the way down. The prongs squeeze between the bottle and the cork. After pushing the prongs down, you use the handle to twist and to pull straight up. Since you never compromise the cork with that needle, it does not crumble. So I would recommend using an osso for any bottle over 10 years of age. They're not expensive. You can get them, have several of them, and use them whenever you want. They're also perfect for young wines also. I love the next question that was put by Yashika's Intuition. I love red wine chilled. What's the big deal about that? Well, this is a question I receive all of the time. One of my biggest rules for drinking wine is to drink what you like. Don't let anyone tell you you should or you shouldn't like a certain bottle. That's why my tagline is, I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. So my answer is, it's not really that big of a deal at all. However, temperature does have a huge impact on the aromas and flavors of wine. There are ideal temperatures to serve wines at. White wines are typically served cooler than red wines. When you serve wine at its ideal temperature, you are allowing the wine to express itself in its best form. If red wines are served too cold, they tend to taste thin and harsh. While if they're served too warm, like above 65 degrees, its freshness and flavors will be muddled. But again, I cannot stress enough that if you like it chilled, drink it chilled. For long-term storage of wines, it is recommended to maintain them between 50 and 59 degrees. For reference, here are some recommended serving temperatures for various wine styles. For sweet wines, it's recommended to serve between 43 and 45 degrees. Sparkling wines, between 43 and 50 degrees. If you have a light or a medium white wine, such as a Sauvignon Blanc, like a stainless steel aged white, you want to serve that between 45 and 50. Whereas if you're going to pull out a full oaked Chardonnay, like one of those butter bombs, California butter bombs, or a full-bodied wine such as Burgundy, then you want to serve that between 50 and 55. The lighter red wines, you serve at 55 degrees. And then those full-body red wines, you want to serve them between 59 and 64 degrees. I hope that helps. And again, drink what you like. And now, a word from our sponsor. Did you know that Dracena Wines now has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a little jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites. We are betting that we are one of your favorite wineries, so we thought the name was apropos. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year, your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, DracenaWines.com, and find out all of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank. Max G asks, what's a consistently good region for wine? For example, lots of people tell me Portugal is delicious and underrated. So this is a great question, Max. There are so many amazing wine regions out there, and determining which region is good is dependent on your palate. Something to look for is whether the fruit comes from a cool climate or a warm climate. Cool climate wines tend to typically have higher acidity and lower sugar and tannins. In warmer climates, grapes ripen more easily, leading to lower acidity, higher sugar levels, and a darker color. So if you know you like warmer climate fruit or cooler climate fruit, that can help you determine which wine regions or grape varieties you would tend to like. So aside from that, there are wine regions that are famous for their wines. Chablis is Chardonnay, and in my opinion, some of the best with its green fruit and citrus flavors. Côte d'Or in the heart of Burgundy is famous for its Chardonnay. Look for labels such as Meursault or Poulinet Montrachet. Cooler Australian regions for Chardonnay, look at the Yarra Valley, Margaret River, or Adelaide Hills. In New Zealand, look for Marlborough or for Chardonnay. In Chile, look for the Casablanca Valley, and in Argentina, you're going to want to head over to Mendoza. If you prefer Pinot Noir, look for Bourgogne in Burgundy, Neuf Saint-Georges or Beaune, Pfalz and Baden in Germany are known for their Pinot. Central Otago and Marlborough in New Zealand, and Morning Peninsula or the Yarra Valley in Australia are the big dogs for Pinot. In the United States, Oregon has really made quite a name for itself when it comes to Pinot. Bordeaux is best known for its Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot blends. Merlot is more dominant on the right bank, while Cab is king on the left. In Australia, Cabernet is best grown in the Coonawarra and the Margaret River regions. In New Zealand, look to Hawke's Bay for high-quality cab. In Chile, the Maipo Valley is a standout. Stellenbosch, South Africa, also makes some great cabs and Merlot. Look to Napa, Rutherford, Oakville, and Alexander Valley for domestic cab. Karen J. made a great point. There are some styles of wine that can really vary in quality, like Sauvignon Blanc. I've had some horrible Sauvignon Blanc, but occasionally a good one. How can wine lovers know who makes the good stuff? You know what, Karen? This is a great question and is a perfect follow-up to the previous one. Your comment about having some really bad Sauvignon Blanc and then some good ones is not just limited to Sauvignon Blanc. There are bulk wine regions and premium wine regions for every grape variety. So as with everything in life, there's good and there's bad, and yes, there's awful. Unfortunately, Sauvignon Blanc is a wine that there is quite a bit of bulk out there. Sauvignon Blanc grows best in cool climates. So if you're looking for some highly recommended wine regions for Sauvignon Blanc, I would suggest Sancerre or Poulet Fumé in the Loire Valley. Marlborough, New Zealand is synonymous with Sauvignon Blanc, as well as the Adelaide Hills in Australia and the Cape region of South Africa. Each region will have a different profile, so you need to experiment with what characteristics you prefer. The Loire Valley in France will be extremely mineral. New Zealand will be more tart with a greenish note and even sometimes a bit of jalapeno. And California tends to be crisp with melon flavors, while South Africa is kind of a blend between the Loire Valley and California. And our last question comes from Paula J. And when I read it, I got all warm and fuzzy in my heart because there's a connection there. So she asks, how long can I keep a white wine? Does it age like reds? Should I throw out a 1998 Ferrari Carano Chardonnay? So first off, anybody who knows me knows that Ferrari Carano is my epiphany wine. I talk about them all the time. It's kind of almost border-like stalking. I loved it so much. The wine that got me into wine was a 2002 Ferrari Carano Chardonnay. It was so amazing to me that Mike actually scoured the tri-state area purchasing every bottle he could find for me. And although there are many white wines that can age well, Paula, I'm gonna have to say that my best bet is that your 1998 Ferrari Carano is past its prime. I wouldn't say you have to throw it away. It's not going to make you sick, but I'm going to bet it isn't tasting as well as they would have wanted you to be drinking it in, and it's probably past its prime. Now, although red wines are definitely more often thought of when it comes to aging, German Rieslings, White Rioja, Burgundy, these all age amazingly well. And they really don't even reveal those layers of that complexity that they have until after decades of storage. So please don't think that only red wines age. There are more and more white wines that are proving themselves to be age-worthy. Thank you to everyone who sent in these questions. I had so much fun answering them. I enjoy being able to share my passion with wine with others and am always happy to answer questions, and these were really some great ones. I would love to do this again in the future, so if you have any additional questions for me, please leave a comment or send me a message by way of the socials. I'm everywhere across the board as Exploring the Wine Glass. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review so others can find me. Before I leave, once again, I would just like to wish everyone a fantastic 2020. Sláinte. This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, slàinte.